Hey, y'all, it's Chip Patterson from the Cover 3 Podcast, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network. College football is about to enter its first ever 12-team playoff era, so join me, along with Tom Fornelli, Danny Cannell, and Bud Elliott, as we drop new episodes 5 times a week to close out the year. We've got reactions, bracket breakdowns, and best bets for these matchups with championship stakes. Follow and listen to the Cover 3 Podcast on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Stonehenge, this prehistoric stone circle located on the Salisbury Plain in England. It's a mystery that's puzzled researchers and the public alike for ages.
We were allowed inside of the circle, and I went there during a cold, misty morning in August. And I have to say that was quite a, as a scientist, I don't want to use terms like magical or mysterious, but it actually maybe was quite powerful experience being within the circle and looking up at the rocks around you.
That voice you just heard belongs to Anthony Clark. He's a soon-to-be PhD holder from Curtin University in Australia and one of the lead researchers who unlocked yet another level of the Stonehenge mystery this summer.
So his research was focused on the Altar Stone, is what it's called. It's a 6-ton block at the center of the circle. But in studying that stone, Clark and his colleagues discovered that its origins are actually far from the place where it has rested for centuries.
I've always found Stonehenge really cool and fascinating.
As have I. One of my daughters, in fact, one of her best friends grew up in a little village in England about 10 miles away. And she says, we've met her, and she told us that they just kind of put up with it because of the tourists. But the tourists still come, even though they're not allowed to get as close as they once were.
Wow, yeah, I couldn't imagine living near some place that's so mysterious, but then also becomes kind of so banal and kind of an eyesore because people are visiting it with fanny packs and digital cameras and stuff. But from the moment I came across Clark's research this summer, it was in an article from one of my teammates, I knew I needed to have him on the show. Because Stonehenge is one of the most offbeat things, is this mystery. And how did he find out that this altar stone was from far away? How did it get there? I knew we needed to ask him about it.
And you are in luck because I did ask him all about it. But I can't promise that we have all the answers. Stonehenge likes to keep its mysteries. That's one of our producers, by the way, Lauren. And I'm your host, Mike Rogers. This is Something Offbeats.
Tell me about your line of research and how this became a subject of interest for you. The altar stone, I guess, is what we're talking about today, correct?
That's right. My PhD has all been about geochronology. Geochronology is a science of dating geological material. That can be a single crystal to an entire rock. Now, using geochronology, you can address diverse questions in geology, from the age of fossils to the provenance of stones to the age of a volcanic eruption. It's very, very powerful.
In layman's terms, how is this possible? We hear about carbon dating and things, measuring the age of antiquities. Rocks, though, that would seem a whole different game. How do you do that? What do you look for? Certain minerals? What?
It's the same principle as carbon dating, but just on a much longer geological timescale. We use the decay of uranium to lead. Uranium is too big of an element, and it will decay to lead over time. We know the rate at which that decay occurs, and we can measure the ratio of uranium to lead in lots of different kinds of crystals to work out how long that crystal has formed since when it crystallized.
As for Stonehenge, tell me about your interest in that. When did it pop into your head to try and determine the actual age, not just the age, but the location where some of these stones came from?
So it was actually a chance encounter with one of the other co-authors on the paper. I emailed Nick Pierce to work on some other unrelated Welsh rocks. And he said, hey, you have these fantastic tools and equipment in Australia. Do you want to have a go and try and date the altar stone, try and work out where it's from? And of course, I jumped on that opportunity.
Tell me about the altar stone, a little bit of the history. Stonehenge, this dates back, they began constructing it between 3,000 and 4,000 years BC, correct?
That's right. Stonehenge was constructed over several time periods. The altar stone itself is a 6 ton slab of rock that sits at the heart of Stonehenge. It's currently flat-lying at the center of the monument. It may have once been upright as a 2 meter high megalith. Actually, when you visit Stonehenge, you can't see it. It's this rather ordinary, unphotogenic rock that's partially buried under two of the collapsed sarsens on top of it.
What is the significance of the altar stone?
Well, for many, it's the center of festivities. It's the focal point of the biannual gathering at the solstices. The final rays of light in the winter cast its light on the altar stone. And then in the summer, the rising sun in the middle of the summer casts its first rays of light on the altar stone. So things at the center of things are normally the most important. Maybe it was 5,000 years ago, too.
Until I heard Clark say this, I have to admit I didn't realize that festivities still happen at Stonehenge today. I always thought of that something happening in the past.
No, it is still going on every year in June and December, in fact, on the solstices. That's when they let people in there. So this is a very big time of year at Stonehenge.
It seems like we probably missed the boat on the winter solstice, but in case Odyssey wants to sponsor a trip for us over the summer, I looked into the summer solstice festivities, and there is a music festival happening there from June 18th through June 22nd. The bands look really fun. There's one called Fae as Folk, another one called Medicine, which is described as the resident pirate band. I'm not super sure what that means, but it sounds interesting. There's also Liz LaFay and Pete Jackson, who is described as an Irish and Ukrainian singer. That's kind of an unusual combination. I'm also Irish and Ukrainian, so that was interesting to me. Do any of those sound worth the trip to the UK to you, Mike?
You know, Lauren, it's almost like you just ran down my top five on Spotify Wrapped, because I've always been a huge fan of pirate bands.
I thought so. I had a sneaking suspicion, Mike.
We've got the solstice coming up here in a couple of weeks, so they'll be gathered around the altar stone again.
I'm taking my girlfriend there, and she's very Australian, so I don't think she's ready for the cold weather. But I'm hopefully enough layers should be okay.
Tell me about the testing on the altar stone. You had to have been surprised at what you learned.
We were definitely surprised. Unfortunately, you can't go up to the altar stone and smash a bit off with a hammer, as much as I would really love to do that. So we were left to work with two microscopic slides, glass microscope slides of rock that had been sliced very thinly. We can analyze the microscopic grains within those glass fragments to figure out their age using the uranium method I explained earlier. We analyzed minerals called zircon, apatite, and rutile. And we worked out the ages for all of those grains, and that gives us, say, a fingerprint, a kind of DNA signature for that rock, which we can then forensically compare to other rocks in Britain and Ireland.
Let's start with the age. Approximately, how old is this stone?
The altar stone is unique at Stonehenge. It is a sandstone, which means it's made up of lots of different grains. You can imagine grains of sand at the beach, squished together, compacted. That means that it really doesn't have one true age. It has lots of different ages of the grains that make it up. The rock itself formed during the Devonian geological period. It formed in a massive lake bed. You could imagine perhaps the Death Valley today for a similar kind of environmental analog. But importantly, the individual grains that make up the altar stone give you that fingerprint of where it formed.
And where did it form? Not nearby, was it?
No. So in general, the rocks in Britain and Ireland, as you go from south to north, become older and more igneous and volcanic. So actually, for such a small country, the bedrock, the geology of Britain is really diverse. And that means that the rocks that form from the erosion of rocks, like sedimentary rocks, can be pinpointed to precise areas in the country. The altar stone has some very ancient grains within it, up to 3 billion years old, which is well over 70% of the age of the Earth. The only place in the UK where you get such old, ancient bedrock is Scotland.
And Stonehenge is nowhere near Scotland.
Stonehenge formed in the Orcadian Basin, of northeast Scotland, which means that it was transported some 300 to 400 miles southwards during the Neolithic.
Now, help me out here, because this roughly coincides with the invention of the wheel. They may or may not have had wheeled vehicles to help get it that far. How did they get it all the way to the south of England?
Yeah, when we worked out it was from Scotland, we thought there's no way. There's no way that people did this 5,000 years ago. But when we thought about it more, for us, there were three options as to how they did it. Maybe it was moved not by humans. Maybe it was moved by ice. Maybe it was moved overland by humans using wheels, as you've described. Or maybe another way was it was moved via a marine shipping route using boats to transport it southwards.
Further south, there was another mystery about giant ancient structures that was actually solved, and it involved water.
That's right. The mystery of how they moved massive blocks used to create the Great Pyramids of Giza. As of 2014, we know that a process of wetting the sand in front of contraptions for moving the blocks was used to get them across the desert, and that's according to Live Science.
Now, of course, the terrain between Scotland and the Salisbury Plain very different than the Egyptian desert.
Yeah, moving a stone this big would be a challenge even today.
What is the weight of the altar stone?
It's a 6-ton rock, 6,000 kilograms, which even today, using machinery and using lorries and trucks would be a very difficult journey southwards using highways. I suppose with enough levers and muscle power and human ingenuity, anything is possible. But if we look at the landscape of prehistoric Britain, it was heavily forested. It was a temperate rainforest, boggy, marshy. It wasn't cleared like it is today. So an overland journey would have been immensely difficult.
It seems to me that they would have just found a stone nearby and said, you know, we're good with this.
People have said that to me a lot, and I think, as humans, we're fascinated with finding the perfect stone for our project. Look, for example, for Kim Kardashian. She spent millions of dollars buying Calcutta marble from Italy for her kitchen. That was transported halfway across the planet just for her to have the perfect rock for her house. Maybe the average Neolithic Briton felt the same way.
How is the altar stone different in terms of the composition from the other stones that surround it?
That's what makes Stonehenge unique, really. It's made up of different rock types from different areas. Most other monuments, prehistoric monuments in the UK, are made up of local rocks. The large, famous upright sarsen stones are made up of a rock from the local area, about 10 miles away from Stonehenge. The smaller rocks, called bluestones, are from where I grew up in southwest Wales. But the altar stone is the only sandstone. It's not an igneous rock, and it's not another kind of sedimentary rock. It is it's unique in terms of its composition.
Could this discovery, the research that you've been doing, help us come to a better understanding of what Stonehenge is, its purpose?
That's a great question. Stonehenge, I think one of the enduring mysteries will be the why. The people that built it, they didn't leave a written record. So we are forced to turn to the rocks and the archaeological remains that these people left. We know Stonehenge is a celestial calendar. It tracks the movements of the sun, and it looks like it tracks the movements of the moon too. Farming and the tracking of seasons was probably very important to the people that built Stonehenge. So we know it was for that. We also know it was a burial site. Where the altar stone fits into this bigger narrative maybe will be one of the unanswerable questions in the Stonehenge story.
Do we know what's underneath the altar stone?
Yeah, there have been digs to look at what's underneath the altar stone, and it looks like it's just earth. There were lots of digs done in the 1920s, and that's where I actually got my small fragments of the altar stone that I worked on.
Do you have those? Did you have to give those back, or do you still have them?
I had to very promptly give them back. You know, if you can believe me, it's easier to work on Apollo 11 lunar samples than it is to get rocks from Stonehenge.
Is that right? You're going to get a moon rock easier than a piece of Stonehenge. Your personal theory, your personal belief is that this was just a big calendar, that's how it began, as a calendar used for perhaps agricultural purposes.
That's right, yeah. I'm not an archaeologist myself, and I work with my archaeological colleagues, and that seems to be the consensus today. Clearly, the people that built Stonehenge went to a lot of effort to build their monument, their temple, on the Salisbury Plain. Why they decided to transport rocks from each corner of Great Britain is lost to time. But we know that Northeast Scotland, where the altar stone came from, It was a center of population and farming and trade. And we know that southern England was much the same. The Worthy Ulsterstone, a real tangible connection between these two people groups.
There's so much mystery. There always has been surrounding Stonehenge. And you just added to it. You realize that.
I did, yeah. I think Stonehenge is somewhat of a research black hole, I think. The more you put into it, the more you don't get out. And I look to all of the other monuments in the UK. Some of them are overlooked and some are just as impressive as Stonehenge. Maybe if we also look at them, some of the mysteries of ancient Britain will be unraveled.
What's it like to visit Stonehenge? I've never been there. Is it a kind of an unusual experience?
I've been as a tourist and I've been as a researcher. As a tourist, I think it's something worth doing. It is an amazing experience. And when you are up to the stones, you do realize their scale and their, you know, architectural sophistication. As a researcher, we were allowed inside of the circle.
And that's where Clark had that powerful experience he described at the top of the show.
I've always been fascinated by Stonehenge. I visited as a young child, so it's an enduring part of my interests.
Standing in there in that mist, did it make you wonder what it was like 3,500 years ago, back in the Neolithic times?
It did, yeah. And I also realized that, you know, I'd made a pilgrimage, if you will, from Australia to the UK to study Stonehenge and visit Stonehenge. And I think that's what people have always done throughout history. They've traveled to Stonehenge to do what they intended to do there. It's always been a point of travel and pilgrimage today as it was 5,000 years ago.
I'm Mike Rogers. Thanks so much for listening to Something Offbeat. This episode written and produced by Lauren Berry and Chris Blake. Audio editing by Chris Blake. And original music by Myron Kaplan. Gotta keep listening. Please subscribe to us on the Odyssey app, Spotify, Apple, wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have your own offbeat story that you think we should cover, we'd love to hear about it. Send it to us at somethingoffbeat@Odyssey. That's AUDACY.com.